From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was all calibrated smiles and careful public handshakes at the G8 summit in Evian, France today. But beyond the stilted fence mending, there was worry. A world economy still in the doldrums, transatlantic foreign policy and trade tensions, and now question marks over the future of globalization itself. Not everyone wants to go forward anymore. Tonight on Point, the G8, the world economy, and a surprising slowdown on the globalization express. We begin tonight with the latest from the G8 summit. Markets around the world have watched to see whether the big power rift over war in Iraq and U.S. power projection could slow the integration of the global economy. All eyes were on Evian for a symbolic show of unity. Earlier, I spoke with Christopher Rhodes, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, currently in Evian, France. I asked him to give us a sense of the G8 summit so far.
Well, there's been a lot of smiles and handshaking and patting on the back and hugs and even some kisses, which given the state of things a couple of weeks or months ago is pretty remarkable. There was even about a 25-minute meeting between French President Jacques Chirac and President Bush, which was widely followed and watched here. But ultimately, a lot of the differences from before remained, and a lot of the acrimony was basically papered over. And even Bush left a bit early. He left earlier this afternoon, European time. And the summit still goes on for another day or so. So he bolted, which was expected, but still shows that he's moving on to other things.
That means that the president, in part, I suppose, was not around for all of the discussions about economic growth. What's on that agenda, and what's come out of those discussions?
The main thing that people seem to be talking about, and it wasn't actually on the agenda, but it became something that leaders here just couldn't ignore, and that is the dollar. And it's continuing to weaken in the last weeks. And that might be good for the U.S. economy with its exports and also perhaps easing the deflationary concerns. But for the rest of the world, which to a large degree has relied on exports to the U.S. economy, that's bad news because, of course, it makes their exports more competitive, more expensive in the U.S.
And Christopher Rhodes, you've written that beyond the dollar and the foreign policy contretemps that we've seen in the last few months, there's a broader concern over the future of globalization itself, that it may be threatened by acrimonious relations between the big powers. Is that part of the conversation at the G8 meeting?
I think it's a subtext. I think that we're not hearing leaders talking about globalization per se and globalization at risk, but I think that's hanging over the meeting or in the background in some way. And it's clear that the recent period of globalization that really got underway in the 1970s was driven to a large degree by more liberal economic policies, more open policies by more and more governments. So, in other words, if it's more of a policy-driven process, it's not automatic. I mean, it can theoretically be reversed as well.
As markets around the world and market makers watch this meeting in France, do you think that they'll see enough congeniality to reassure them that the big trends in globalization are still on track, or might that be in remission?
My guess is that simply seeing these leaders together would be taken as a positive sign. I mean, usually you'd hope for more substance from a meeting like this. But given how poor things were just a few weeks ago, I think just having these leaders together, particularly the French and the U.S. and Germany as well, leaders from those countries, just showing that they can work together is probably a positive sign, and then suggests that, you know, that can lead to more substantive initiatives down the road.
And what about more substantive issues, trade and economic generally? Will there be impetus toward future meetings out of this one? Will there be specific steps taken at the G8 meeting?
I think the big thing that people were watching in that regard was the what would be said regarding trade and the so-called Doha round of trade talks has essentially come to a halt during the Iraq War and through this acrimony. And so people were hoping that there would be a strong statement there, which they did give. But at the same time, the differences and some of the conflicts over that, the trade talks, namely agriculture subsidies and genetically modified foods, they were not discussed. So some of those key differences still remain. But we basically just have a sign that they want to, there is at least a desire to confront them.
And overall, Christopher Rhodes, what's the sense at the meeting? A world economy on the rebound or still plagued with weakness?
They tried to put a very positive face on things. Tony Blair in particular talked about pension reform going on in a number of countries. Germany finally appears to be addressing its inflexible labor market and high unemployment benefits. And so there are some signs of movement on the big structural reform that a number of these countries need. But I think it might be more hope than reality at this point. There's still some big risks out there to the global economy, namely deflation and, of course, this SARS respiratory disease out of China and some other and of course, the fall of the dollar. So there's some big risks out there.
Bigger issues than one meeting of eight leaders can put to rest.
Yes, I think so.
Christopher Rhodes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Christopher Rhodes is correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us earlier from Evian, France. For the past decade and more, the globalization juggernaut has seemed unstoppable, but maybe that presumption of surging inevitability was simplistic, even naive. Now, war, political divisions, trade tensions, active resistance, and even SARS seem to have thrown globalization into a lower gear. Some analysts see the loss of momentum as just another brief lull in the avalanche of globalization's destiny, two steps forward, one step back. Others aren't so sure that it's just a lull or that it will be brief. Globalization has taken some long retreats before. Could that be happening? Again, is globalization taking a breather? For how long? And if it is that a calamity or a blessing? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Washington is Charlene Barshefsky, former U.S. Trade Representative and Chief Trade Negotiator for the United States from 1997 to 2001. She was at the center of many historic trade negotiations, including China's entrance into the WTO and the development of the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Good evening and welcome, Charlene Barshefsky.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, thanks for joining us. Also with us tonight from Washington, Clyde Prestowitz, President of the Economic Strategy Institute and former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce in the Reagan administration, where he led U.S. trade negotiations with Japan, China, Latin America, and Europe. He is author of Rogue Nation, American Unilateralism and the Failure of Good Intentions, published just this week. Good evening and welcome, Clyde Prestowitz.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Charlene Barshefsky, let me turn first to you, if I may. We just talked with Christopher Rhodes with The Wall Street Journal. You no doubt saw his page one story in the Journal on Friday saying, hey, look out, the big globalization express is sidetracked or slowing dramatically here. Globalization itself could be going into remission. What do you think of the thesis, Charlene Barshefsky?
I think it's quite a bit too early to tell if that's the case. There's no question, of course, that trade and investment flows have slowed, but there's also no question that the large global economies are also contracting, which, of course, has an effect on trade and investment flows. In addition, some would argue that the dollar had been overvalued, and that further exacerbated difficulties for the United States, particularly for our export performance, which was lagging as well. I do think that there are certainly pressures on the global system. Terrorism, of course, the war, of course, now, ironically, a falling dollar. But I think it's too early to say that globalization has stopped or is necessarily in the process of reversal. I think we have to always keep in mind that one of the basic elements of globalization, that is capital flows, global capital flows, as well as extraordinary information flows, continue essentially unabated.
Clive Prestowitz, what's your view? There was a powerful sense in the 90s of a kind of straight-line inevitability about this process, that we were rushing straight to the global village and there would not be detours, that technology, new technology, had made that impossible. Could we be headed into a period of hiatus or lull in knitting up that globalization picture?
I think so, yeah. I think you used the term lower gear a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. I think we're in a lower gear, and I think the question now is not so much do we get to a higher gear, but are we going to go, you know, to still a lower gear? I think there are several factors. One of them is that we've gotten, I mean, it's actually a mark of the extent to which we've globalized, but to go further with globalization means really attacking the really tough issues. You know, the issues of agriculture and domestic regulation, which are extremely political and just very, very tough. That's number one. Number two, I think there is a growing doubt about globalization in places like Latin America, where it doesn't seem to be working. In my travels through Latin America, I hear people saying, gee, you know, we've done everything you told us to do. We've privatized, we've democratized, we've deregulated, mm-hmm. we've made things transparent, and we're poorer now than we were before. And then this gets tied up to the other phenomenon, which is China, because people say, hey, China didn't democratize, it hasn't liberalized, it's not more transparent, there's no rule of law, and yet the Chinese are getting rich. And so there's a sense in some places that somehow the theory of globalization is not kind of working, the facts are not working the way the theory says it should. And then that gets even more dangerous because people then begin to question the efficacy of democracy.
The efficacy of democracy or globalization or both?
Well, because we have tied globalization to democratization.
Mm-hmm.
If globalization doesn't work, then people think, well, democratization doesn't work either.
Clyde, the way you describe it there, it sounds like you could be describing not necessarily just a hiatus, but a kind of retreat.
I'm very concerned. I think the trade negotiations everywhere, Doha, Free Trade Area of the Americas, all of these major efforts are bogged down and going nowhere. On top of that, we have, as I just said, this phenomenon in Latin America and elsewhere questioning globalization. On top of that, I'm advisor to several multinational companies, some of whom have begun to ask, should we rethink our global manufacturing, particularly looking at the growing dependence on China, and then you have something like SARS. So there's just a lot of factors out there that give me pause about, you know, where globalization is going.
Jack Beattie, what are you thinking as you listen to all this? Globalization has been a mighty wind, to cite a phrase, in the last couple of decades. But is it inevitable that it go to the conclusion that everyone expected?
Well, I don't think it's inevitable for the reason that Christopher Rose said, that it's a policy-driven process. That this isn't just simply market relations and technology unfolding inexorably. These are the decisions of governments and of the WTO and of the IMF. And a prime example of how policy-driven it is in the front page of the Wall Street Journal today. It tells the story of how at the Doha round 18 months ago, we agreed as an effort to fight, work toward justice in the third world, part of our anti-terror strategy, to have our drug companies liberalize their patents such that third world countries, African countries notably, could import drugs. Since then, what has happened? Well, one thing that's happened, pharmaceutical companies gave $50 million to the Republican Party for the November election. And lo and behold, right after the election, we switched our policy. Now we say, no, we don't really want all the medicines that we said were going to be lifted just for malaria and a few other things. Well, there's a prime example of how, you know, policy, naked politics, interferes with trade liberalization.
Jack Beattie, Clyde Prestowitz, Charlene Barshefsky, stand by. We're talking tonight about the flagging momentum for globalization, about pushback against the one world economy. You can join the conversation. Is the big push for one world economy losing ground? Is slowing globalization a bad thing or a good thing? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the flagging momentum for globalization, about pushback against the one world economy. You can join the conversation. Is globalization inevitable? Do global technology and communications make it irreversible? And can you imagine countries and regions hunkering down in opposition to globalization? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Charlene Barshefsky, former U.S. Trade Representative during the Clinton administration and chief U.S. trade policymaker during that administration, and Clyde Prestowitz, founder and president of Economic Strategy Institute, former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce in the Reagan administration, a big negotiator during the 1980s with Japan, China, Latin America, and Europe. Author most recently just come out of a new book, Rogue Nation. You can join the conversation as well, 1-800-423-8255. Charlene Barshefsky, you've heard the skepticism here tonight about where we are in this push for globalization and the possibility that we could face a real hiatus. Do you buy that? Or do you think that technology and communications you were talking about earlier make it inevitable and make a certain forward speed inevitable as well?
Well, look, globalization is not a phenomenon separate from the operation of markets and or separate from the operation of economies. It is instead the culmination of the operation of those economies, including their individual and then collective growth prospects.
So you're saying it's not just about policy, that there are forces beneath at work here?
I think it's both policy. Obviously, policy is critical. One need only look to global policy pre-1914 and then post-1914 to see that policy makes an extraordinary difference. But so too do the operation of markets. I do think that Clyde is right in the sense that the most difficult issues with respect to trade liberalization are coming to the fore now, most particularly agriculture trade. But I think it's also important to note that at the G8 summit, developing countries want the process of trade liberalization and increased global integration to continue. They want it on their terms, and I think they're right to want it on their terms. That is to say, on an end to agricultural subsidization and so on.
Which is so large in the United States and Europe.
It is massive. If you look at what rich nations provide for agricultural subsidies, you're talking about $1 billion a day. That is six times more than total aid given to all developing countries combined. This is an outrageous situation. But my point is that it would be ironic if wealthy nations turned away from increasing aspects of economic integration, while at the same time poorer countries are actually asking for a greater share of the global pie through enhanced trade and investment opportunities with the larger nations, that is to say, through a kind of globalization that takes into account their particular development needs.
Clyde Prestowitz, I wonder if you could walk us through where we are right now in that arc of trade negotiations. You say that we're now up against the really tough stuff. I used to cover you pretty closely in the 80s when you were in the middle of negotiations with Japan. They look pretty tough to me. If this is a lot harder than that, that's very hard indeed. Where does the world stand with Doha? And if you could generally characterize where things stand with the big upcoming issues in trade negotiation.
Well, I think Doha is bogged down largely over the agricultural issue. There's no deal in Doha unless the developed countries, Europe, the U.S. and Japan, make substantial cuts in agricultural subsidies.
For people who haven't followed that, can you describe what is Doha and what did it anticipate?
Well, Doha is, of course, the capital of Qatar, where the last meeting of the World Trade Organization took place. And at that meeting, a round of international negotiations was launched to further reduce trade barriers. It became known as the Doha Round because that's where it was launched. Mm-hmm. The heart of any new agreement will be a trade, and the trade is that agricultural markets, which is the developing countries basically have agricultural products to sell. They can't sell them either to Europe or the U.S. or Japan now because those markets are protected and subsidized, Even worse, they can't sell them to third countries because the subsidies make the U.S. and European products less expensive on world markets.
And more competitive than theirs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the deal has to be that we and the Europeans and the Japanese get rid of the protection and the subsidies, or at least a lot of it, so that the developing countries can, in fact, sell what they grow.
Given the political power of agriculture in all of these countries, does that mean that the developed world has come to the end of the line in terms of its own interest in going further with globalization?
Well, I mean, that's the question. In my view, the developed world has a great interest in getting rid of these ag subsidies. But as you pointed out, agriculture in the developed world seems to be politically very potent. And in fact, the U.S. has increased its subsidies.
So
this is a very, very tough nut to crack.
Jack Beatty, Clyde talked about Latin American countries coming away from globalization disillusioned. Are we seeing here some first world second thoughts about globalization as well? Hello, Jack, are you there? I think we may have lost him. Charlene Barshevsky, let me put that question to you.
Last year.
Oh, there he is.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now, Jack. We lost you for a moment. Oh, sounds like you might have lost.
The effect of U.S. cotton subsidies on Africa. We spent in 2001-02 $3.9 billion on subsidies for cotton farmers here. That's more than the entire.
Jack, we're going to have to work in that line. Please stand by. You're cutting in and out on us. Charlene Barshevsky, let me put the same question to you. How does the first world deal with the really tough questions coming up now about constituencies that don't want to give ground, agricultural subsidies first and foremost?
I think this is going to be very, very difficult, particularly for the Bush administration in 2004, which is an election year, which is one of the aspects that cast the Doha agenda in some significant doubt, at least over the next several years. Agricultural interests are, of course, very, very powerful. As the saying goes, every district in the United States has a farm. The same is true in France. The same is true in Germany, Poland, in Japan, and in many, many other key countries in these negotiations. And there is no question that there are in particular, two aspects that have to be resolved. One is the elimination of agricultural export subsidies. U.S. Export subsidies in this area are about $300 or $400 million a year. Europe's are $7 billion a year. It's a lot. It's a big hunk of change to get rid of. Second is the reform of domestic support programs. That is, programs that favor rural development, on the one hand, are considered completely fine and appropriate and desirable, but if those programs are linked to agriculture production, they are viewed as terribly trade distortive, impinging on the growth, among others, of developed countries. Those trade-distorting domestic supports have also got to be reined in. And here we're talking in a combined number of hundreds of billions of dollars annually. So there is a lot of constituent pressure, obviously, to maintain these large sums. There's extraordinary pressure from developing countries, quite appropriately, for the U.S., Japan, and Europe to get rid of these large sums so that, as Clyde says, there can be open competition, particularly in areas where developing countries have a comparative advantage and should be able to sell, but today cannot because they can't compete against subsidized exports. And for the U.S., Europe, and Japan, and to some extent Korea, this will require extraordinary political will and political fortitude. And I agree with Clyde, if there is not significant agricultural liberalization to be had, the Doha round will absolutely fail because there would be nothing in it for the developing world.
Clyde Prestowitz, paint us a picture then. Let's say that it does fail. It seems entirely possible that political interests in these first world countries will be successful in blocking movement here. Can you see a picture where globalization, it just stalls out where it is, or it begins to reverse, unravel, actually sort of turn around and go backward?
I think the issue is time frame. I think that over any long period of time, globalization will reassert itself simply because of the shrinkage of time and distance engendered by technology and the logic of comparative advantage in economics. But, you know, Norman Angell wrote a famous book in 1911 arguing that he didn't use the term globalization, but in the early 1900s, international capital flows and trade as a percentage of GDP were almost as high as they are now. And Angell wrote this book saying there could never be another war because globalization had gone so far. And that was 3 years, of course, before the beginning of World War I. It took from 1914 until about 1995 for the world to achieve the same level of globalization that it had in 1911. So you can go through a long hiatus here.
Do you think that that is repeatable, or was that unique to the 20th century and the 21st century?
Hey, who knows?
Such a
who
gap.
Knows?
Yeah,
you know, I mean, all of us a couple of years ago would have said, I mean, we would have all been like Norman Angell. A couple of years ago, we would have all said, couldn't possibly happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the last couple of years, we've seen things that we didn't expect. So, you know, I think that we need to think about this hard to prevent it from happening.
Jack Beatty, we lost you on the line there for a moment, but I think you're back. In this lull, what do you hear going through the minds of first world countries, of third world countries, about globalization itself?
Well, you know, the title of that book by Norman Angell may well be apposite here, The Great Illusion. And more I'm hearing that. I'm hearing it from Joseph Stiglitz. I'm seeing it inter alia in economists, young economists like Danny Roderick. People who are having sort of fundamental doubts about the terms on which globalization has been proceeding.
You mean not the fundamental assumptions? I mean, because the idea of efficiencies and you know, the people who can make things most efficiently should dominate those markets. That seems to make sense globally, doesn't it?
But the question is for whose benefit? And thus far, it seems to be the new consensus emerging among these economists, at least. The people who have benefited have been financial interests and corporate interests. And the question raised by demonstrators at Evian over the weekend is the one really that's to the fore, people before profit. Are people in the third world today benefiting from globalization? Are American workers benefiting from globalization? Which ones? Under which terms? And, for example, if we're going to intervene in the market to affect drug, you know, say, no, you can't, we're going to keep up our patents on drugs, you can't take them and so on, that's market intervention. Why can't we intervene with, say, a global minimum wage or global labor rights? In other words, we're intervening in the market to protect corporate interests, but not the interests of people.
Well, there's a vote on the people side. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's invite them in. Doug's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Great. Thanks. I'd like to echo those last comments I heard. That's exactly what I wanted to talk about, is that people try to equate globalism with free trade. And what we're doing, actually, is we're enacting currency ratios and we're enacting trade policies that actually benefit U.S. multinational corporations and no one else. I mean, NAFTA has successfully dropped real wages in Mexico. I think I read in Noam Chomsky's book, down by 56%. And another thing that bothers me about these trade policies is that a lot of these things, like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Multinational Agreement on Investments, actually all these things are done in secret. And there's no democratic process here. These people and these organizations circumvent, in many instances, the rule of law.
So, Doug, are you objecting to the fundamental idea of globalization or the way you see it as having been carried out?
I am very upset about the way it's been carried out. Free trade is one thing, but let's not skew it only to benefit U.S. multinationals and not others. Japan, for example, actually was very successful controlling capital flow during their economic rise. And I think that that's been one of our demises. In the United States, it has negatively affected workers here and abroad, and the elites have benefited from this. So that needs to be addressed, and I really support the previous comments saying that why don't we, instead of trying to incorporate policies that only benefit us, let's try to use globalization to work for example, like the gentleman said, a minimum wage, better health care.
Doug, we've got it. I want to turn to our guests. Thanks for calling, though, and I want to invite in right now Frank Vargo. He's Vice President for International Economic Affairs at the National Association of Manufacturers. Good evening and welcome, Frank Vargo. Fargo.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. Frank, you've been listening in, and you've been no doubt following the global debate about globalization. Where do you see it standing right now? Is this a reversible trend, and who wins and who loses if there's a lull or a pushback against globalization? Does the United States win or lose?
Oh, I don't think it's reversible at all. I think it was inevitable the day the container ship was invented and the day that air freight became economical. You cut the transportation costs 80-90%. You cut telecommunication costs by 95%. You cut trade barriers. And you're going to have an increasingly integrated world. And that's really all globalization is, saying more and more countries and more people will participate in the world economy.
But what happens when some countries and some people stand up and say, this isn't working for us, whether it's American farmers, if subsidies are confronted, or Argentine manufacturers who don't like manufacturers pouring in from elsewhere?
Well, when you look at Argentina or you look at American farmers, you have to look at what are the policies that brought this about and what makes sense for the future. And, you know, Argentina borrowed $140 billion and didn't do anything with it. So it was kind of inevitable what happened in Argentina. And they can come back with good policies. What you have to do is to position yourself well in the global economy. And a real problem for the United States now is, where are we going to go? What policies do we need to have so that we can maintain our very high standard of living?
And what are you suggesting by that? More globalization or less? What's your view?
Well, the globalization is going to occur whether we like it or not. What we have to look at is, where are we going to be there? Are we going to be the high-cost producer? Are we going to be the high-technology producer? Or how are we going to price our goods?
Is it possible for American workers in American manufacturing companies to prosper and have globalization?
Oh, I believe we can, but we have to have the policies that really favor that. You know, we have to look at our tax policies. We have to look at all of the factors that go into production. And we also have to look at the cost of our currency, because that has really put us out of the market and has been, in my mind, the single biggest factor that's been affecting American jobs.
Even now when the dollar's become so low?
Well, the dollar's not low. You know, it's still about 10-15% over where it was in 1997, as the Federal Reserve Board measures it, because the Chinese currency hasn't moved since 1994. You know, the Korean, the Taiwanese, all these Asian economies, the countries, the governments keep their currencies very cheap. Why? In order to be able to develop an export surplus to the United States. And that's the major factor in our huge trade deficit, not trade policy.
So there's a vote that says keep it coming. Frank Fargo, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Frank Fargo is Vice President for International Economic Affairs at the National Association of Manufacturers. We are talking this hour about the flagging momentum for globalization. You can join the conversation. What priorities should drive globalization? Corporate profit, social needs, national security? And are you ready for a rest from globalization, or are you gung-ho to push ahead? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the flagging momentum for globalization, about pushback against the one-world economy. My guests from Washington, Clyde Prestowitz, former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce in the Reagan administration, leading trade negotiations with Japan, China, Latin America, and others, author of new book, Rogue Nation, American Unilateralism and the Failure of Good Intentions. Also from Washington, Charlene Barshefsky. She was, from 1997 to 2001, under Bill Clinton, U.S. Trade Representative and a chief U.S. trade policy maker there, and our own Jack Beatty is with us as well. You can join us. Is slowing globalization a bad thing or a good thing? Is globalization inevitable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bernice is calling from Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Bernice.
Hi. I think the globalization is unfair trade, basically.
Did you say unfair trade?
Yeah, and it's basically a drive to drive the wage out of existence in this country. You know, it's slave wages overseas. But the thing that really helped it so much to have buy overseas, with the United States, Germany, and Japan all put money in to hold the value of the American dollar up, the U.S. dollar, because this way, as you've said on the program, the dollar, when it was expensive, our companies could get things from overseas much more cheaply than if it was a low value to the dollar. So the dollar, and periodically, and then financial page, you would see that the United States, Germany, and Japan were propping up the value of the dollar.
So here's no big vote for globalization. Bernice, thanks for calling.
Yeah. And the other thing is that when we ship, are you there?
Yes, I am.
When you ship grain overseas, it's been a policy of this globalization to drive out farmers, say, in South Africa. And then of course, the price of wheat or corn went up over there, but temporarily our farmers get a better price. Whenever there's armitage in selling and buying, when you don't produce what you produce in another in your own country, that price goes up if you sell more overseas.
Well, but we've got subsidies that are keeping it floating all along. But Charlene, I want to take your basic critique and put it to Clyde Prestowitz. Clyde, the notion that many Americans, particularly in manufacturing areas, have that globalization has been a net loss even for American workers in terms of wages. On the other hand, there's been an awful lot of cheap goods that have come into the United States that make the cost of living lower. How do you see that after the last 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, I think your last point is the right point. Workers tend to focus very much on what happens to exports, not realizing that imports can be good for them. And just think about the 1990s. We had less than 4% unemployment. We had globalization going like crazy. We had wages rising rapidly in the U.S., there was a shift of jobs. American workers shifted from low value-added manufacturing to high value-added services and manufacturing. So what was happening was we were importing labor-intensive goods and freeing up American workers to do jobs that were more valuable, that created more value, and therefore paid more.
But
wages rose as we globalized. Let me just say that a word for globalization beyond the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Globalization is the greatest driver of increased living standards we've ever seen. Our own living standards have risen dramatically in the last 50 years, and so have those of Europe and Japan and Southeast Asia because of globalization.
So when people complain that it's hurting them in the pocketbook, and we've seen just in the last couple of weeks big stories in the press about wages falling in the United States and low wages abroad as a big part of that, you think they're just not seeing the whole picture?
They're not seeing the whole picture. No, that's correct. I mean, there certainly are instances when a particular company or a particular industry may suffer adjustment. But if you look at the thing on the basis of the overall economy, that's not the case. Now, that's not to say that the people who are in those particularly affected industries or companies aren't suffering real pain. They often do suffer real pain. And one of the things that we have, but we need to have more of, is adjustment assistance so that when those companies are hit, that we have an ability to shift those workers smoothly into better training and other high-paying jobs. But the last thing we want to do is to stop the adjustment, because stopping the adjustment is what has happened to the Japanese economy. It's what's happened to the German economy. It's why they're growing slower than we are.
And what if the adjustment just stops on its own, or at least slows? What if there is a real lull in globalization? What impact do you imagine from that, Clyde Prestowitz?
We'll have slower growth domestically. And we'll have stagnating standards of living in the U.S., with probably higher unemployment and lower wages.
Jay's calling from North Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. It's interesting to hear everybody talk, because a lot of the presumptions in the statements people are making, and the guests and so forth, are along the lines of, we can control this, when in fact isn't a lot of globalization really just human Darwinism, in a sense, behavioral Darwinism, where I can find a good that I can buy cheaper elsewhere, so I'm going to do it, or I can find a piece of information cheaper here that I can find it, or I'm interested in consuming some bit of something that somebody got somewhere else and I can find it cheaper here.
And yet, Jay,
you happen without our control?
Well, and yet, Jay, you know that for decades, that kind of interaction, that market interaction, was controlled by tariffs and all kinds of trade restrictions. The notion that we heard earlier in this hour that this is partly, in your word, Darwinistic, but partly policy-driven.
Could well be, but clever people in this day and age, with the amount of communication that we have, seem to be able to find a way around it. It's like water flowing out of rock.
Mm-hmm.
Seems hard to stop.
Got it. Jay, thanks for your call. Charlene Barshefsky, what about it? If it's ultimately inevitable, could the process be slowed by international tangles along the way in such a way that it doesn't end up as anticipated?
Well, look, let's look at regions of the world that have essentially isolated themselves from globalization. Because it's one thing to recognize globalization itself has very many positive aspects, but also some downsides. It's another to begin to look at the question, all right, what if we were operating under a different system? Well, there are two regions of the world that do operate under a different system, and I can't imagine we'd want to emulate either, and that is sub-Saharan Africa, which has essentially isolated itself from globalization, extraordinarily high tariff barriers, fragmented economies, no economy of scale among producing countries, and the Muslim Middle East, highly fragmented, high tariff barriers, don't trade with each other, don't trade with Israel, only sell oil, highly commodity dependent. In other words, if you look at those two regions of the world, you see areas whose per capita GDP has shrunk significantly over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. GDP in Muslim Middle East has declined 25% since 1980. In sub-Saharan Africa, fully 30 nations are poorer today than they were 30 years ago.
Jack Beatty, can you imagine you want to see North America or South America, for that matter, joining sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East economically in their opposition to globalization?
No. I mean, you don't want to be isolated from it. I guess the point I would just make is that in the end, this will only stand if people in governments support it. And this means that it has to work for farmers in Africa. It has to work for manufacturing workers here. It has to work for ordinary people, because in the end, they're going to cast a ballot. And this issue that Clyde raised about, you know, it could delegitimate democracy in Latin America if this thing falls apart.
You mean if it's imposed on countries where the people don't want it?
That's it. And, you know, we've gone through this IMF Washington consensus experiment that was sort of one size fits all, and that for many countries effectively kicked away the ladder of development. And I think there's some rethinking now of this policy of the 90s and saying, wait a minute, we've got to get popular support for this if we're going to go ahead.
Clyde, can you see how that might be engineered, and is it in the offing? Could a new approach come on stream that would actually raise support for globalization?
Sure. Part of it is what Charlene said earlier, which is getting serious about agricultural subsidies. And we could start doing that right here at home by setting the example. for example, we have a NAFTA agreement, which in fact has done quite a lot to stimulate growth in Mexico. But we could do more. The Mexicans, one of their big products is sugar. We have strict quotas on sugar imports into the U.S. So here's how globalization affects and doesn't affect consumers. And after all, consumers are workers. Americans, when you put sugar in your coffee or you put sugar in your cake or what have you, you're paying about 10 times as much as you should. Because you could buy that sugar on the world market at a much lower price, but because of our import quotas, you pay a much higher price. Effectively, we're protecting growers in southern states and in Hawaii in the United States.
But in the atmosphere globally right now, do you see the United States or Europe dropping those agricultural subsidies,
well,
or are we headed into a different track here, a
side track? I'm hopeful, if only because in the war against terror, we not only need a military card, but we need an economic card. We need to provide some hope for people that they don't have to become terrorists. And one way to do that is to buy their stuff, give them a chance to grow something, to sell it to us. So I do have some hope there. The second thing that I think we could do is actually consider reverting a little bit to what I call managed trade. But, for example, for years, most of the post-World War II period, textiles were the industry that provided the initial developmental growth in developing countries. It began with Japan, went to Hong Kong, and Korea, Thailand, and so forth. And we had, in the U.S., we had textile quotas so that we were protecting our domestic industry, but we gradually expanded the quotas. And we would say to the Japanese, you can sell us so much, and you people in Thailand can sell us so much. We got rid of those quotas in the Uruguay last round of international trade negotiations, and we've virtually phased them out, with the result that China is taking virtually all of the business.
And off it goes. So, Clyde, we're almost out of time. I want to put one last question to Charlene Barshefsky. Charlene, if we're in a rough patch for globalization, we've just got 20 seconds. How long can it last?
I think it's not clear how long it can last. I think it will depend in part on whether there is a resurgence generally in the economies of the developed countries. I think it will depend in part on whether developed countries are genuinely responsive to the needs of the poorest countries by further opening our markets, though that is politically difficult for us to do. I think it will depend, as you said initially, Tom, on policymakers and the policies that they choose. And I think also, per Jack's comment, it will depend very heavily on whether we look at globalization not as a phenomenon isolated from the public good, but instead one element in a much more comprehensive program of societal development here in the U.S. as well as in poorer countries.
And with that, we've got to go. Charlene Barshefsky, Clyde Prestowitz, thank you to you both for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to end this hour with sounds from some of the major players at the G8 summit, which concludes tomorrow in Evian, France.
I want to thank Jacques Chirac for his warm hospitality. We've had a really good meeting. This morning we talked about our common desires to grow our economies.
Well, of course there were tensions during the Iraq War. We had a fundamental disagreement. But it's interesting that in the United Nations we've come back together now. And in the discussions that we're having on proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, I think you will find there's general agreement. I think you'll find it's a pretty strong statement that comes out from the G8 countries, and there's a general acceptance this is a significant and serious issue.
Well, don't believe everything you're told. I met with President Bush in a very positive manner, looking at possible solutions at the problems we are confronting. This will continue, these discussions will continue tomorrow, and are in no way a source of concern or worry to me.
First of all, people have mentioned the war in Iraq, and we recognize there were differences. Secondly, there is also a sense that people are coming together. The reason why President Bush is leaving is a reason why, which is understood by everybody, that the Middle East peace process is now moving forward. This is of fantastic importance.
I have decided to triple the French contribution, moving from $50 to $150 million. Now, I certainly hope we will be followed, that others will follow suit.
I fully understand this is going to be a difficult process. I fully understand we need to work with our friends, such as France, to achieve the process. I know we won't make progress unless people assume their responsibilities.
George Bush, Tony Blair, Jacques Chirac, and street protesters from the G8 summit in Evian, France. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.